Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpy and Peter Torpy.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete. This week we'll be talking with someone who not only created some of the first electronic accessible books, but was also a pioneer in developing many of the standards that are now incorporated into making media accessible by the visually impaired.
We'll speak with George Kircher about how he did that and how these standards have been assimilated into mainstream publishing. And next week, we'll continue the conversation and hear about some of the quandaries that have arisen as a result of this great success. But first, for our tip of the week. This week's tip is, if there's something you need and you have at least some of the required skills, try to make it happen yourself. And we will hear that story with George Kircher and Accessible Digital Books today. But we've done other episodes of Eyes on Success where we spoke with the originators of JAWS and NVDA, Hotspot Clicker, JSonar, and other projects.
And although those are major projects that you may or may not have heard of that have impacted lots and lots of people around the world, not every project that results from some need has to impact as many people. Sometimes it's just as good if you can develop something for your own use or even for a few number of people. And sometimes something as simple as producing scripts to customize how your applications work with your particular screen reader can make your own life more pleasant and your work more efficient. And so if you have a need, just figure out how to address that need and you never know.
Let's start by meeting George Kircher.
My name's George Kircher. I live in Missoula, Montana. And I usually work out of my home, and I'm blind. And because I live in Missoula, I end up having to travel quite a bit to different places and events. So my second home is inside some kind of airplane.
That's terrific.
Yeah, and Delta just recognized this and gave me a 2 million mile award traveling with guide dogs for 2 million miles. So that was a lot of fun. And Delta had a lot of fun, playing that up and promoting their organization and promoting guide dogs. And it was a lot of fun.
That's pretty cool. You know, I think it's kind of funny, though, how your reward for traveling a whole ton is to get more free mileage.
Yeah. Well, I tell this joke about, you know, traveling a lot. And Delta has this rewards program where you have silver, gold, platinum, diamond, and then divorced. And, you know, the goal is to stay this side of that divorced tier. So
that can happen.
That's great. As you'll hear in this week's and next week's show, George has been pivotally involved in Learning Ally since it was recording for the blind, with the DAISY Consortium, and with the Diagram Center, but that's not all. What else are you involved with?
I'm chair of the steering committee for the Web Accessibility Initiative. So working with Trudy Brewer and the people in the way at the W3C. But, you know, that's standards as well. So, and very connected to the W3C. And let me see, 3 years ago, I received the presidential appointment to the Institute for Museum and Library Services, IMLS.gov. So I'm on that board.
Well, I guess all of that certainly keeps you very busy.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. Success, 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 success.
This week's focus topic is how accessible ebooks initially came into being and how the standards for them have evolved.
So I understand you were not blind when you were born, but you began to lose your vision later in life, and that partially motivated you to get into the field that you eventually did. Is that right?
Yes. So I have retinitis pigmentosa, And when I was 30 years old, I gave up my driver's license voluntarily and passed the eye exam because I could see straight ahead, but I couldn't see anything out to the sides. And I was teaching at the time and losing my vision more and more. So I went through a low vision phase and decided to get out of teaching and went back for a master's in computer science. This was 1985.
And I understand that was not an easy journey to bridge that gap. There were not a lot of programs in place to make these things accessible or, you know, so that the blind could actually be involved in these fields.
That's right. And I could change the contrast and background colors and see for about a year more. And I used a closed circuit TV to magnify things. And then got my first talking computers probably in 86. But there were no books available at the graduate level for computer science. And I talked to the folks at Recording for the Blind and asked them if they had any books that I could read on my computer. And they didn't know what I was talking about. So I started writing letters to publishers and asked them for the stuff that drove their printing presses.
What kind of reaction did you get from the publishers?
One publisher sent me some files and I looked at them and they looked all like garbage to me and threw them in a drawer. And at the end of the semester over Christmas break, I started to figure out what these things were. And I wrote a program to convert those materials to the first digital book.
So just to be clear with our listeners, I mean, this is something where you knew at some point printed books had to be in electronic format. So you went to the publishers and said, hey, look, you have it in electronic format. I can use a computer as a blind person. Can we work something out here? Can you give me your files? I already bought the book.
Oh, yeah.
But they were totally unreadable.
Right. That's exactly correct. And I knew computers were driving the printing presses, but I didn't know what file formats they were in or anything like that. And so I wrote this software and it was time consuming and, you know, took maybe a month to write this over the Christmas break. And when I finished, I had three books that they had sent me because the one program converted all three books. And it only took 2 seconds to run the program to convert the book once you had the software figured out.
Right. Ages to write the program and only 2 seconds to run it.
That's right. So I'm reading this book and my computer's voice is reading it to me. And I just said, oh my God, this is fabulous. This is just absolutely amazing. And boy, one thing led to another. The University of Montana helped me out in trying to get this idea off the ground. And I contacted Microsoft and asked them if I could get their files for a lot of the documentation. And got a call, and my wife said, a Ms. Dawes called, MS Dawes.
Oh, how funny.
And so I got the phone number and ended up calling the person back. And she said that other blind people were asking for the same thing. So I wasn't the only one thinking like this. And she said, we haven't found a company that we could give our files to that would allow us to make these available. We'd love to do it, but there's no company.
And of course, you weren't a company either.
No, I wasn't. But I immediately started a company like 15 minutes later. I just came up with a name and talked to the people at the university, and they agreed to allow me to start this project under the University of Montana as Computerized Books for the Blind. And I added on there Print Disabled. So Computerized Books for the Blind and Print Disabled, which coined the term print disabilities. So once I announced this to a few people and told people about it, they were very excited. And I started to get phone calls, and email didn't exist at that time, but it grew like wildfire. Very quickly, I had 1,000 people all over the world who were wanting to get some of the fundamental books that they needed to learn how to use a computer Running MS-DOS, for example, was one of the books from Microsoft Press that was very popular. Documentation on WordPerfect and DBase and those kinds of programs. I didn't have very many titles, but they were in high demand. I knew what I needed for myself. And it was true that all these blind people throughout the world that were learning about computers needed the same titles.
I'm curious, what format were these books in on their way to the printing press? Did Word even exist at that time? Or PDF?
No, this was pre-PDF, pre-Word. And they were in a typesetting format, and there were many different typesetting formats, but they were all very regular. These were professional companies. They had like mainframe computers that were driving these printing presses. And it was all codes inside the files that directed the printers what to do. And I could tell that this was a heading based on the information in the file. This was 18 point and, based guessing that this big, bold thing with one line was a heading. And sure enough, they would have A heads, B heads, C heads, which was the structure of the document. They would have markers for paragraphs and block quotes, and it was very nicely marked up. And that's how all the files were back at that generation of time.
Were there standards back then, or did everybody have their own proprietary markup language?
It was all proprietary. Everybody had their own. But it was just at the beginning where SGML, Standard Generalized Markup Language, was starting to take hold. Jumping forward to 92, and the company I founded at the University of Montana was merged with Recording for the Blind. And that's when Recording for the Blind started their eText service in 91. And the problem, that you face immediately when you start doing this is, what are you going to use as a standard for the books? And I said I was using ASCII, the American Standard Code for Information Interchange.
Basically just text.
Flat text. And, ASCII was, 128 characters. That was it. That's all you could represent in ASCII at that time.
So we started out with no standards. How did the development of standards get underway?
I got a grant from the National Science Foundation, a little teeny $50,000 grant. And they have said that this was the best investment they ever made, because it's kind of starting the whole digital publishing arena and accessibility. But I went to an SGML conference in 92. And it was all technical people, all involved with publishing and standards, and a very technical group. I did a presentation, and they got it. They just understood how this information could be transformed for people with disabilities. And the technical community has always been embracing the notion of having this technology being helpful to people with disabilities. So it was great. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. So that was the beginning of the standards, move into the standards era.
Right. That sounded like a great idea to actually standardize this stuff. Because if you had a translation program for one format, it necessarily meant that someone else had a different format and your translation program wouldn't work for that. So everybody would have to keep on reinventing the wheel, so to speak.
Right. And a couple years later, the World Wide Web started, and that was a proprietary format to begin with, and version 1 moved into HTML. So that was the beginning of HTML, and it was a flavor of SGML. So SGML is just a way to do it, and HTML, hypertext markup language, was the few tags that were used at that time to do the first web pages.
So that was the beginning of standards, but things have gotten a whole lot more complex since then. How did the standards evolve to handle the complexity?
we had a group of people that formed called the International Committee for Accessible Document Design, ICAD, and we came up with a really small set of elements, tags, 22 of them, and only three were different from the first version of HTML, almost identical, coming from two different directions and came up with the same fundamental basic tagging for documents. About this same time is when the WYSIWYG word processor started to become popular.
And for those who don't know, that's what you see is what you get.
Correct. But then with the advent of desktop publishing, people could just drag their headings around and visually format it. And it abandoned that whole notion of the semantic information. All you cared with your software was what it looked like. And that created friction between what people with disabilities needed and what was being produced by the mainstream. And it also meant that converting these files became much more difficult.
Let me tell you, we've gotten bitten by exactly that problem ourselves. So I maintain the website for Pete's Trio, which is torpytrio.com. And with Pete's advice, I created this thing in Publisher, and it's beautiful. It's got all these pictures from the previous performances and all this stuff. But boy, to have Pete's Trio's website totally inaccessible is kind of embarrassing. But at this point, it's huge. And to rebuild it in something else would be a Herculean task. So we live with the consequences.
Well, that's where you get to some of the principles of accessibility, which is the separation of presentation from the structure and content. The semantics had to be preserved, not just the visual appearance of things. So HTML has the elements like we've discussed, but they also have cascading style sheets. And this is great for a blind person creating a document because you could just use a style sheet that says, I want my headings to look like this, and I want my paragraphs to look like that. And all you have to do is put in into your document itself the information that it is a heading, and you let the styles worry about the automatic formatting of the document. And interestingly, you can also navigate that document through those headings, even in Microsoft Word. But there's, you know, people like the WYSIWYG, but if they use name styles, then we have harmony between the two worlds.
And our experience with Publisher was exactly what you were talking about, the difference between the semantics and the presentation. She made beautiful looking web pages with Publisher, but the screen readers just couldn't deal with the layout of the page. And so semantically, links were not organized. How my screen reader, you know, saw them was not the way they appeared on the page to the person viewing it. And there are all sorts of problems. So when we created our website for the radio show, eyesonsuccess.net, we decided, look, we're going back to basic HTML and style sheets, and then it'll be very well organized and easy to access with screen readers.
Now with CSS, you can make websites look terrific and at the same time be wonderful for people with disabilities. That's where a major portion of work with the Web Accessibility Initiative has focused. So the WCAG Web Accessibility Content Guidelines come to play, and they, you know, fundamentally you want to separate the presentation from the semantics, and you don't want to convey information just through color. You know, you could just change the color of things, but you should be using semantics to convey the information. And you can have it look, as long as you've got good contrast, make it look like whatever you want. But it takes more knowledge on how to do that correctly. And we've really come a long way. There's a lot more people out there creating web pages that look great and work great, but it's a constant challenge to make sure that that's going to happen.
So you talked initially about working with Recording for the Blind to make materials accessible to visually impaired people, and then HTML was being developed about that time. How did you get the larger community to buy into some of these ideas of standards and accessibility? Was that a big hurdle?
Well, the DAISY Consortium, this was 1996, they were formed, and they needed to find a replacement for cassettes, because everybody at that time knew that the cassette was going away. And they had all this recordings, great recordings in reel-to-reel tapes, and were being distributed on cassettes, and all different types of cassettes. So there was in the United States the 4-track, there was still the 2-track, there was the 6-track in the UK, and some were half speed. So there was no standards even in the blindness community. So the sharing of books across country boundaries, you really couldn't do it. You could do it between Canada and the United States because we're both using the 4-track half-speed cassette. But that was about it. So when DAISY came forward, they knew they had to move from cassette to digital, and the DAISY Consortium decided to move to standards. I ended up getting hired by them as a subcontract from Recording for the Blind and Dyslexic. And we started working on the standards for that. And in the blindness community all over the world, there was a push to standardize the file format and to make sure there was plenty of players out there, reading systems. So Shinano Kenshi with the Plex Store and Humanware with their DAISY readers and HIMSS with theirs and Dolphin and APH with the Bookport now. Everybody wanted to be able to distribute one file and have it used by any of the reading systems. So that was standardized. And we had software that validated and made sure that the files were correct. So this was 96, 97, 98.
Many of our listeners have been enjoying DAISY material for a really long time, but I understand DAISY is an acronym. What does it stand for?
So DAISY stands for Digital Accessible Information Systems. It is a consortium of libraries serving blind and print disabled people throughout the world, and we're in almost every country. And we needed to develop the standards that we needed for ourselves to keep our organizations going. Now we're focused on making the mainstream publishing accessible through our participation in the International Digital Publishing Forum. That's the people who do the EPUB standard. And then, of course, this is moving into web publishing. And we're in working groups with the W3C and the IDPF that are collaborating on where is this all going, publishing on the web.
And these days, the mainstream publishing industry has been accepting and incorporating the DAISY standards into the mainstream arena.
That's right. In 99, the first commercial started with the mainstream on digital books. And we jumped into that, and right alongside the mainstream community, the DAISY Consortium got involved with what was then the Open eBook Forum. And we had already had 10, 12 years of experience creating digital books, and the mainstream was just in its infancy there. So we knew a whole lot more and actually guided them down this path of development for the digital book. So we really did, the blindness community really did lead the sighted community in this first go on digital books.
So to me, this is a fascinating story. I mean, this is one of the few circumstances where some technology developed primarily for the visually impaired was really great for that subgroup of people, but it was actually taken up by the larger community. to make useful for everybody. I mean, I remember having these Daisy players and be able to read my books and go from chapter to chapter or sentence to sentence or whatever. And, you know, my wife couldn't do that on her MP3 player. She's fully sighted.
Yeah.
So, you know, she had to poke her eyes out to take advantage of this technology. And this is a great story of how the technology was kind of transferred. How did that transition happen?
Boy, you know, once you start moving into the mainstream, things start happening very quickly with a lot of very powerful companies out there. So it was like riding a roller coaster. I mean, we really had to hang on, but we did a good job of hanging on.
And next week, we'll continue the conversation with George, focusing on how several issues which have arisen due to this great success of incorporating the DAISY standard into the mainstream have been resolved, and some of his thoughts on what lies ahead in the future. Now for this week's final item, how to contact George Kircher and learn more about some of his other activities. If people want to contact you directly, is that okay? And if so, how would you recommend that?
Sure. Kircher@montana.com. That's KERSCHER@MONTANA.com.
And can you give the URL for your website?
You could go to kircher.montana.com, and I've got a very simple, old-fashioned website that needs updating. I have a brand-new guide dog, Kroner. He's only 20 months old. We graduated 2 weeks ago from Guide Dogs for the Blind, and I got to get our graduation picture up there.
Cool. I saw your website. It was very nice. You had all your grandkids listed there, and it was a real nice, clean, simple to use, and just told who you were.
All coded by hand in a text editor.
Good man. That makes it accessible for sure. Well,
oh,
thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Have a good day. Bye-bye. And if you're looking for more information on the organizations that were mentioned throughout the show and some of the standards committees, we'll have all that in our show notes along with George's contact information. Just go to www.eyesonsuccess.net and look for the show notes associated with this show.
That's it for show number 1539. Next week on Eyes on Success, we'll be continuing the conversation with George Kircher and learn why having uniform standards had led to some concerns about copyright and distribution issues and how he and other people have worked to resolve these issues. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net or call us at 585-258-0333.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman Torpey and Peter Torpey and distributed by WXXI Reach Out Radio. Browse the full archive of programs, find instructions for subscribing to the podcasts, and much more at www.eyesonsuccess.net. You can also find us on iTunes, follow us on Facebook and on audioboom.com, at Eyes on Success, or Twitter @_EyesOnSuccess. We hope you will join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. Thanks for listening to Eyes on Success and have a nice day.